It's a delight to be here and a delight to see Daniel again and meet Jane. Where'd everybody go? There you are. My wife Gloria is here with me today. And so I'll just get right to things here. The book that Daniel mentioned, Decision Making God's Way, that's a publisher's title. I don't know that I would have titled it that way. It's a little bit precocious. But the fact is they want to sell books. So when you read that title, you definitely want to buy the book, say. But a new model for knowing God's will. And when we ask, that's what the book's basically about. There are three parts in the book. The first part is that we have a problem of knowing things. As soon as we ask the question, how do we know God's will? Or how do we know anything? Whether it be a medical issue to medical challenges in our lives, to nursing homes for aging parents, to what school you should go to, whom you should marry. A lot of very important decisions in life. And as Christians, we want to negotiate that from this standpoint of knowing God's will. And yet, as I've studied this issue, I'll say this several times today, I have good news for you. God's will is not lost, so you don't have to find it. The Bible never talks about finding God's will. It talks about doing God's will. And so in light of that, the first third of my book is about Christian worldview. How do we know what we know? What's our source of knowledge to negotiate the things that happen in our world? Then in the middle of the book, I actually move from Genesis to Revelation on the subject of knowing God's will, and deal with lots of passages, all the way back to the Abraham servant who was seeking a wife and an heir for Israel, right up through the end of the Bible, particularly with Paul, who talks a great deal about this subject, and asks, what does the Bible say about that? So about the middle half of the book is that way. And then the last three chapters are on subjective challenges. What is the role of conscience? What is this voice inside of us anyway? What is the role of the Holy Spirit in a Christian's life in this decision-making process? And what is the role of prayer? So there are three major pieces in the book, and obviously with our short time today, I'll do about 3 50-minute lectures, open to questions at any time when you have them. Just feel free to interrupt, and except for Daniel, he can't ask any questions. And we'll have some refreshments in between those times so that it breaks our time up a little bit together. I've brought copies of the book with me, and we'll merchandise them if you have an interest. They're $10. They're $13 in the store, so you save a little bit of money plus tax. So that's a good deal. And if you didn't bring any money with you, just see Daniel. I'm sure he'll be glad to loan you whatever you need. Okay? Now, I'll turn around a little bit. I moved a file, and I'm not sure that all of my little bells and whistles are still there, so I'll have to look at that up there occasionally without my monitor to see that. But I want to talk to you about this question about decision-making. Now, normally I'd bring them in a nice way, you know, bullet by bullet, but I haven't gone back in to fix that since I changed from one computer to another. Somewhere it lost it. But there are several things involved with decision-making as Christians. First of all is that question of how do we know what we know, a biblical way of knowing. Epistemology is the technical term for that, because when we study ourselves and we study our world, we study from the standpoint of who are we, how do we know, what should we do. And the Bible makes it quite clear that all of our actions are a process of thinking. As a person thinks in their heart, so are they. And in the ancient world, the heart was the seat of the intellect. Bowels of compassion, the older versions of the Bible will read, that was the seat of emotions. Our culture thinks of the heart emotionally, Valentine's Day, things of that nature. But the ancient world thought of the heart as the place where you do your thinking. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ with all your heart. Confess with your mouth that he is Lord. That's not an emotional process. That is a thinking process to move toward God. So how do we know what we know? How do we know that what we know has validity? And then we run into the next challenge. What about three people who are together and seem to know it differently? The challenge of competition for a view of something. All these are all very important questions that come to bear when we think about even this issue of knowing God's will. And I'll talk some about that. A new way of thinking. For a lot of Christians, worldview, Christian worldview, is not so much in the matrix of things. A lot of churches in the United States, for some reason, don't have a tradition of what a worldview means. And I'll try to introduce that. Maybe you do. I'm not really that aware of your tradition here. An understanding of how a worldview works. A view of how to read the Bible. We say that the Bible is sufficient for all faith and practice, for everything about our lives. But then we go to the Bible to find an answer, and we don't find a verse. Now, if we're creative enough, we can turn a verse into what we want, but we don't want to do that. That's what I call hermeneutics, is the name of the course Daniel mentioned, which is a word for the interpretation process. I call it hermeneutical ventriloquism. And the Bible's the dummy, and you make it say whatever you want. And, you know, creative people can do those kinds of things. I've done that on occasion. We can all do that, but we don't want to do that. We want some processes whereby we can try to find out what the Bible's actually saying about an issue. So there's some issues about reading the Bible that I want to talk about a little. And even though we can only give a very brief survey today, you can read at length in the volume on these items. Whoops, confronting subjective challenges, and I mentioned the issue of conscience. I'll come to you later today and ask you the question, is it true or false? Let conscience be your guide. It's a famous little phrase. Martin Luther, at the Diet of Worms many years ago, during the Reformation in the Western world, said it's neither right nor safe to go against one's conscience. Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise. What is the role of conscience in a person? What are these voices inside of you? That's a subjective thing, internal to our processing. The issue of the role of the Holy Spirit, a lot of passages and theological issues on that. And then the question of the role of prayer. So subjective challenges, then a system to sort of work through decision-making processing. Today you received a handout with my slides, and at the end is a large chart we'll look at later. It's just an example of what ought to be going in to our thinking process as we deal with decisions in life. And those decisions can be anything from something that's quite simple to something that's quite complex. Now, discerning God's will requires a number of things. It requires a view of how we know what we know. And as we think about that issue, let's think about the big setup of how the Bible views our world. This is very much in the domain of the question of worldview. A biblical understanding of our world. If we look at the Bible seriously, we find that God has existed eternally. And at some point, God decided to bring time into being. And we think of that from the standpoint of creation. And we have a very brief statement at the beginning of the book of Genesis, just about three chapters, two of them focusing on a kind of a summary of God's creating work. And then in chapter 3, the whole thing gets messed up. There was only one tree in the garden, and that was the tree of what? Of the knowledge, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That means to be able to discern between right and wrong. And that becomes the symbolic piece of the waywardness of our society and moving away from God. And in a book like Genesis, that's 50-some chapters, you only have three chapters that starts it, which sets the pace for the whole rest of the Bible. And then everything else becomes the redemptive story of how God has gone about seeking to bring us back to Him. And so we have creation, we have the fall in Genesis 3, And the rest of the Bible, all the way through, is the story of redemption. God's seeking to bring a people to his name through the Old and the New Testament. And someday, God will consummate this whole earth history situation. If you think for a second, Genesis is the story of creation, and it goes up through the Old Testament to the prophets. And the prophets are at the very end, up near 400 BC, when we get to the end of the prophetic period, they're trying to bring Israel back to where it all started. Because the prophets are kind of like what I call covenant police. The prophets really are not telling us very much to solve our curiosities about the future. God left that for TV personalities, which you shouldn't watch, you know, with all of their amazing ways of telling you what's going to happen, which is mostly fantasy. The prophets tell us very little about those things, but the prophets are constantly telling Israel, you've broken God's law, you have not responded to God. Until you respond to God, we can't get this mess cleaned up. And it comes to a point when finally the prophet gives up, and it goes off to what we call the apocalyptic images, when God will break back into history at the end of time. This is when you get the story of the animals and the lions and the lambs and the child shall lie down with a lion and not be harmed. And you get a lot of this. That's way off into the future. Because the story of the Old Testament is that we've got a mess, and at the end of the day, the only way that mess can be cleaned up is for God to break into history and do something. Well, then we come to the New Testament. And we start with the new creation. Jesus was incarnate and came to the earth. The Gospel of John said that he was the Word and that the Word created all things. And so we start over again, in a sense, with creation. And then we end up with the book of Revelation, which is very much like the prophets. So whether you're Genesis to Malachi, or whether you're the Gospels to the book of Revelation, you have exactly the same scenario as far as the story is concerned. God's created. He's trying to redeem. We resist the redemption. And then someday God will come back and break into history. That's the story. That's the Christian story. The biblical story about life. And it's just that simple, in one sense. And yet just that complicated to fill in all the blanks with all the material that's in between. But in this story, something interesting. There's a dilemma. There's a dilemma about knowing God. Bring up these pieces here. We're back to that same kind of chart. And picture us looking back to see God. But what's happening is that we're looking through distortion. Distortion is the result of Adam's sin. This is the biblical worldview. And we have not only the distortion of our physical world, in a sense, that could be explained in a variety of ways, but we've got a distortion right here. We can't think the way we ought to be able to think about God. Adam must have been an amazing creation. With all of that original, fresh, created capacity. Most of us have varying levels of capacity to learn, to know, to remember. One of the hardest things in life, probably, for each of us, is to accept when we've come to the end of our own capacities. We want to go farther, but we come into that wall. We've all been affected in some sense because of sin. We're all dying as we sit here. The second law of thermodynamics, that everything is proceeding toward its end, toward death. And when we look back to see God, because of the distortion and because of the distortion of ourself, we can't really see God. I want you to look at a passage in the Bible in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. I think you'll hear it, when you hear it, it'll be familiar to you. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Now, I wish I could tell you about the flow of the book of 1 Corinthians. That'd take quite a while. But let me just mention to you, that 1 Corinthians is a book that flows in blocks, like chapters 1 to 4 is a block, then 5 and 6, then chapter 7, then 8 to 10, then chapter 11, then 12 to 14, then 15, and then 16. And they're subjects. Paul's responding to questions. The book of 1 Corinthians is not a friendly letter, because the Corinthians had rejected the apostles' teaching. They saw the cross, as you remember from chapter 1, as foolishness. They were looking for a more impressive way for redemptive history. Now, these were believers. These weren't unbelievers. But they were having trouble with accepting the apostles' teaching. All right? Now, chapters 1 to 4 is particularly responding to that issue. And in chapter 2, 6 to 16, we sort of have the center of this argument. And Paul, notice he says in chapter 2, verse 6, he says, we. Now that's interesting, because if you look back to verse 1 of chapter 2, look at the pronouns. When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence and so forth. I, as I proclaimed to you. All the pronouns are I and you and I and you and I and you. That's the conversation, context. Look at chapter 3, verse 1. I could not address you as spiritual, but as worldly, mere infants. I gave you milk. Okay, I and you, the conversation again. But look at chapter 2, verse 6. We, the pronoun changes. Now, I learned early on that reading the Bible, you know, just reading sometimes can be challenging. Watching how the context change, who's being addressed and who's doing the speaking. Paul is having the conversation with the Corinthians up to 2:6. And then he shifts and says we and us. And then he goes back to I and you. The we and the us is not Paul and the Corinthians. The we and the us are the apostles themselves. Chapter 2, verses 6 to 16 is a statement about why the apostles' teaching is so important. Now watch how this works. Paul says in verse 6, 2:6, we do, however, speak a message of wisdom among the mature. Now who would the mature be? Those would be the believers who are listening and accepting what the apostle has to say. But not the wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. No, we speak of God's secret or hidden wisdom, a wisdom that's been hidden and that God destined for our glory before time began. Now watch verse 8. This is very interesting. None of the rulers of this age understood it, that is this message. For if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. That's amazing, isn't it? However, as it is written, here comes something. Now watch this. No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. I'm reading from an NIV today. I don't know what versions you use here, and I see some that I can't read. But yours might say, it has not entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for those who love him. Now just think about that statement. No eye see, no ear is heard. It hasn't entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for those who love him. How have you often heard that verse used? That it refers to what? Is there anything, have you ever heard this passage used? Huh? Okay, the incarnation? That's not, you have to know what I'm fishing for, see. Okay? I'm fishing for something else. The cross? Not here. To heaven. Have you ever heard anybody say this refers to heaven? No eye has seen, no ear has heard. No one's ever thought what God has prepared for us when we get to the end of our journey to heaven. That's the way I've heard this passage used a lot. But This context doesn't have anything to do with heaven. What's this context have to do with? It has to do with knowing. How do you know that Paul is right or wrong? Now, most of you, when you were in school, maybe you had a course when you talked about how do you know. You know with your senses. You know with reason. You know on the basis of authority. And then there's intuition, which is an interesting piece because it's very technical. It's not what most of you ladies have, you know, women's intuition. Or maybe Daniel's, he turned and came out all right. Had good intuition there. But you see, this statement is about how do you know? No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no one has ever conceived this knowledge of God. That's a dilemma, isn't it? If we stop there, we'd be in trouble. But look at verse 10. But God what? Has revealed. So what is the solution to the dilemma of the fact that we really, at the end of the day, cannot know God? The only solution to that is this issue of God revealing. You can't see that too well, and that's a slide I need to work on. But God's solution to the dilemma, and actually the black part up there, you can see it on the slides that you have, but that's this passage. You see, God has bypassed the dilemma that we deal with in fall and distortion by giving us the Bible. Now, the Bible is an interesting book. Started writing maybe, you know, it depends on your dating of the Exodus, but the Bible basically started with Moses' composition. Now, we don't know how old Job is. He may predate Moses. But it starts, we think about Moses. So we're talking at the very earliest, 1450 BC. There's two dates for the Exodus, 1450 and 1250 before Christ. So 1450 years. Now, Abraham lived in 2000. Abraham never had a Bible. And we've got 600 years from Abraham to Moses and no Bible. There was oral tradition. There were understandings of various kinds. We don't even know very much about that period. But then, so from 1450 up to the end of the first century, we've got a book that was composed over about 1550 years by many different authors in times and place. And yet we find this amazing continuity that runs through Scripture about the very things I've just been talking to you about in terms of who God is and what God does in the world and how God communicates. God communicated through His Word. And so the Word, the Scriptures, become our only reliable source of information about living Christianly. Now we might say, well, what about nature? Doesn't the Bible say that the heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament showeth His handiwork, day into day utter speech, night into night showeth forth glory, in Psalm 19. But who said that? David said that. That was said by a believer who had already decided that God had produced this world. But the average person will not walk out and say the same thing. They may say, this is a marvelous universe. They just found another galaxy, I guess, recently. And it goes on and on. I mean, it blows my mind. What is it? Betelgeuse, the star that has a diameter that's 10 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun. I remember reading that in a science book one time. How big is that? That's mind-boggling. Our universe is so large. And so here we are, this little blue planet. No other blue planets discovered yet. And God has worked with us and given us His Word. And that becomes the foundation for our decision making. And yet there's a challenge, isn't there? From the standpoint of the fact that we have the Bible, and yet sometimes we don't all agree in relation to what the Bible actually says. Have you ever noticed that? That we have a lot of different churches. We have a lot of different theologies. And I'll give you my brief answer to that, and it's this. God has given us a Bible, and in spite of all the challenges of bringing it to us and its composition, and frankly today, the challenge of so many different kinds of translations, I could show you some interesting things there, but we don't have time for that now. But we've got the Word. The problem's not with the Word. The problem's here. It's how we read it. And the challenges of coming to it with different glasses on. And the glasses become the lens through which we read the text, and we come out with different conclusions. So this is where we need to do our work in terms of adjusting ourselves so that our reading has validity. So we've got the solution to our problem of knowing. Eye has not seen, ear has not heard. There's no way that even the greatest minds in the world could know God, but God revealed. So we've got the solution, but the next problem is our taking the revelation that God has given us and being able to use it in the right kind of ways. For example, the problem of the solution on your notes there, page 3. We say the Bible is our only rule of faith and practice. And the Reformation, and this is confessedly very much Western world, but at the same time I think that they got it, says that the Bible is sufficient, it's clear, and it's effective. But then we take the same Bible among Christians and we disagree about the meaning of the Scriptures. Well, what's my answer to that? My answer is this. God has not made us robots. He's given us an inspired Bible, but He never gave us an inspired set of commentaries. He hasn't given us inspired interpreters. Interpretation is a lot of hard work. And how we handle the task has a lot to do with how God is going to judge us at the end of time. That calls for a lot of things. It calls for the fact that we must never give up on being diligent about trying to understand what the Bible teaches about any given subject. And it also means that we've got to have a pretty good dose of humility, because we have some challenges sometimes coming to a final opinion about things. And I've been teaching graduate school for near 30 years, and I sometimes get very worried about what I don't know, what still bothers me, and the next 100 books that just came out that you're supposed to have read already. I mean, if it wasn't that way, it wouldn't be the Bible, would it? The Bible has probably generated more libraries than any other document on the face of the earth. I used to go to the University of Chicago when I was doing graduate work to do research, because they had a consortium of schools that had put their library together, and I don't remember how many books, but this is an amazing figure, but this figure comes to mind, that there were 6 million volumes in the consortium library. It was like going into the catacombs. And a lot of that had to do with religious study with the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. McCormick Theological Seminary, Lutheran Theological Seminary, all these books that had been generated to try to explain the Bible. We built a new office building recently for faculty at our school, and I've got a pretty good sized library, and I was complaining about if they didn't put the lip on the shelf, I could get one more shelf all the way around my office. You know, that's a lot of books. And the carpenter was there, and the president of the school was there, and we were just, you know, I was saying, can't we just do something with this? But it was for the strength of the shelf, so I had, you know, I'd already lost. But the funny thing is the carpenter, who was just a good old boy, he said, you know, I'm really surprised. What do you need all these shelves for? I thought God only wrote one book. That was pretty good. Yes, that's true. God only wrote one book, but we've generated libraries to struggle with what just exactly has God said. There are challenges. And I think that, in a sense, God hasn't given us an inspired library that answers every question we have, because he wants to keep us on our toes. He wants to keep us working at this. He wants to keep us from being like the Tower of Babel, where we get it all figured out and build our own little kingdom. He's given us a life that's full of risk, struggle, tension, and pursuit. And we glorify God by how we deal with that. And we glorify him by our search through the scriptures to try to do that. So discerning God's will requires a lot of things. It requires a new way of thinking. On the one hand, God has disclosed himself. He's left us a record of that revelation in the Bible, as we just saw a moment ago. On the other hand, we're responsible to move out from that record and discern God's will, and yet we still have trouble. So that brings me to what I think is the classic text that you all know, and the one that brings us all together, and of course it's Romans 12, 1 and 2. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you might demonstrate, prove, test, and discern what is the good and perfect and acceptable will of God. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You see, when you became a Christian, in the miracle of conversion, you began a new journey. And it's a journey of relearning about yourself, about life, about how to deal with life. Transformed by the renewing of your mind. Well, what is the content of transformation? The content of transformation is the teaching of Scripture itself. Let me give you one illustration. A Southern preacher said this one time from the pulpit. He said, before he was a Christian, he loved things and used people. Let me say that again. Before he was a Christian, he loved things and used people. He's the one who had that bumper sticker on their car. He who dies with the most toys wins. I never thought that death was a reward. Did you? You know? Have you ever seen one of those? I've seen those bumper stickers on some Porsche or something. It just whizzes by me. He who dies with the most toys wins. Love things, use people. But when you become a Christian, you're supposed to love people and use things. It's a reversal. It's a reversal of values. What's really valuable in life? We chase so many things, don't we? As we live our lives, fame, success, wealth. Sometimes, to be an artist, you can be a starving artist and still be doing the same thing, chasing our dreams, which is good. And yet, only sometimes to get to the end of life and realize we've been chasing the wrong thing. At the end of the day, to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. Now let me give you a simple illustration about how I think we need to image this, about how this works. Transform mind of Romans 12, 1 and 2. Notice how I've drawn the mind. Because I want you to realize when you read the word heart in the Bible, you're reading something about the rational process, about thinking. As a man thinks in his heart, it says in the book of Proverbs, so is he. Jesus said, out of the heart proceeds the issues of life in the book of Matthew. The heart in the Bible is a synonym for the mind and the rational process. So if you want to change the way people act, you have to change the way they think. So we have data that goes through the mind. It comes out on the other end as meaning. It depends on what kind of a mind it goes through. You put in the word sin, just that those three letters that can be very pejoratively used sometimes. Sin. You put that through the mind, of a person, of an atheist. They think of it as, you know, some superficial religious word that becomes a cop-out for people's failures. You put it through the mind of a Christian who's been educated, and it comes out, sin is the transgression against the revealed will of God. It's the violation of God's teaching. God says, do this. We do the opposite. We violate it. God says, have no idols. We have all kinds of idols. We violate it. So it depends right there what comes over here. This data is all the same. But the determination of meaning at the human level is what goes on in here to spit it out on the other side. So if we want to change meaning and how people understand things, how people make decisions, we can't go over here and tell them what we think. We have to help them to go through the process of changing the way they think. When I was a pastor on occasions, maybe for 2 or 3 years, I might have tried to get the board to see something a certain way to do something, usually spend money, you know, usually spend money. And it just wasn't working. Then one day I would go into a meeting, and one of the board members would say, you know what I've been thinking we should do? And he would say what I had been saying the last 2 or 3 years without even having a clue that I had said it. It was his idea. So what do I do? Say, well, you know, I've been asking for you to do that for 2 or 3 years. No. I say, thankfully, I finally did my job. I helped someone change the way they think. And when it became their idea, guess what? It happened. Ownership. Exactly. As a pastor, you know, I might say to a congregation, you need to bring people to the church. You need to witness and help them become Christian and bring them in and so we can teach them. And I can pound the pulpit till my face turns blue. And nobody gets it. Why? Because me saying something has no relevance until a person takes ownership. And ownership usually comes from the process of your own personal experience. Of finding out, well, it's not really that hard at all. It's not that bad. It's really easier than you thought. And these people would appreciate it if you did it, so forth and so on. And then when it becomes something about your experience, it actually happens. You see, this is a transformation. We transform our activities on the basis of transforming the way we think. If we do not value something, we won't do it. And we won't do it just because someone else wants us to. Now, sometimes that works for a while. You know, maybe you like that person, and you can get them to do what you want them to. You'll do what they want to do, but eventually that all wears off if it's not my idea, if it's not something that I have taken ownership of. So you see, decision-making and coming to know God's will is something that each one of us has to take ownership of. Nobody can do it for us. It's not someone else's responsibility. It's each of us individually growing in the grace and knowledge of Jesus Christ and coming to grips with the decisions in life that we have to make and all kinds of decisions, and doing it not from the standpoint of saying, Lord, tell me what to do, and then we wait for a voice that never seems to come. But we have to do it from the standpoint of, Lord, help me to think through this to know what I should value and what's really priority and what's really important in this decision-making process and what is the right thing to do in this context. That takes some thought and work. And it usually takes a community rather than just an individual. So we see this is the transformed mind, but the transformed mind is the worldview and value set. As I mentioned a moment ago, we can run information through different minds and get different answers. If you run, you can run it through the mind of a person who's committed to one ideology and get an answer, to another ideology and get an answer. Well, we could do that into church. We can run it through a Baptist mind and get an answer. We can run it through an Anglican mind and get an answer. We can run it through a Presbyterian mind and get an answer. Because everything resides right in here, which brings another thing to the table. If we don't understand how each of us think, we won't understand our differences. It's in understanding how we see things. That's a hard thing to do. Lots of times I have to remind myself when a student asks a question and not to run to the answer before I'm sure that I understood what the question was. Francis Schaeffer, I'm not sure if you're familiar with his name. He's been gone a long time, but was a very important figure in the church a few decades ago. He was a philosopher, lived in Switzerland, and had a major impact on the intellectual community for Christianity. And he used to say this. He says, Christians are amazing. They have all of the answers. They just don't know what the questions are. You know? And I think most of you know that if you don't know what the question is, you probably don't have the right answer. And so many, many times in our decision making, whether it's within, for ourselves, within a family, within a church, we create more problems than we solve because we really haven't figured out some of the questions sometimes. It's a hard task, and nobody can put that into a test tube very easily. It's something that we have to work through. Now, what is the transformed mind? Well, on your page, which you'll probably be able to see easier, the transformed mind is a process of education that brings our worldview and our values into conformity with biblical teaching. There's a lot of things in life for which there is no Bible verse. I'll give you a challenging one. Do you realize there really is no Bible verse that tells us that abortion is wrong? That's pretty shocking, isn't it? You can't find a proof text about that. And if you go to see what happens to pre-born children who are killed in the womb, in the Old Testament law, for example, you won't like the answer. Because the punishment is not a life for a life, but property. You have to pay for that. But I believe abortion is wrong. I don't have a proof text. What do I have? I have a Bible. And the Bible says that life is important. Now I've got to decide, is this a life? That's another decision, isn't it? When does life begin? And of course, even the medical community has changed definitions on that. From conception to implantation, I'm not even sure what it is today. And Christians will argue about when does life begin. When you've made that choice, then you've made other choices about protecting life because the Bible teaches that life is more important than property. So you see, coming to conclusions about how to make a decision about things the Bible doesn't have a Bible verse for calls for a higher level of thinking. There's no verse in the Bible that says euthanasia. Do not commit a euthanasia. Where's that verse? You won't find it. Unless you want to rewrite the Bible. Yeah. But does the Bible, you know, and this is very hard because how does the Bible teach us about dying? Whose choice is dying? And then you've got the problem of teaching 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago. So Christian thinkers who try to deal with some of these very, very difficult problems in our world can't do it because here's the proof text, here's the verse. They do it on the basis of here is a Christian way of thinking. Here is the product of a transformed mind about how to deal with life and death issues. So it's a process of changing the way we think to conform to biblical teaching, and yet sometimes that's even challenging. We have to think in larger categories about how the Bible teaches. Here's another one. This leads to a decision-making process that is the conscious engagement of our worldview and value system in the everyday struggle of life. So the decisions that we make, and even the discerning of God's will, I mean, Romans 12, 1 and 2 is one of the famous passages about knowing God's will. That passage doesn't say you know God's will by praying real hard and looking and seeing what comes into your head after you pray. Well, that could be, you know, something could come into your head that's the result of what you ate for lunch. It's not necessarily the result of God communicating to you. But if you set yourself up for that process, you're going to live by that process, aren't you? I once did a seminar and a young lady said that every day when she went to work, she would come to these stationary stop signs and she'd ask God, which way should I turn today? And then she'd turn left or right, whatever jumped into her head. She'd never had an accident. And that is a proof that that is how God guides you. Now, how do you talk to people who bring you an experience that they have deified? They have made that divine. And I think that they're duped, frankly. And their life, what happens when they have an accident? Oh, they didn't hear God right. Or maybe, you know, some other explanation. That's not the way to run our lives. Because that might work for a little while, but it's not going to work for very long. And that doesn't glorify God. God is glorified when we reflect Him being created in His image to think, to choose, to reason, as a community as well as individuals, to be able to achieve the goals that we believe are right. So the goal of the transformed mind is to produce a person who with self-conscious deliberation can think critically about life's decisions in a manner consistent with biblical values and sound process. Now you can imagine that when you get a group of people together, even if you get a group of professional theologians together to attack an issue, they're going to come up with a majority report and a minority report. I have some books. I teach Greek, and one of my books is the secretary's notes for the Greek New Testament, and when they compared the manuscripts to decide what the reading is in the text and what is not. And in that little book that explains all the things that committee did to produce that Greek New Testament, there are majority and minority reports. That's reality. That's reality. And so consequently, we've got to be a person who, with this self-conscious deliberation, can think critically about life's issues. We can't sit and wait for some star to fall out of heaven, or for some light to hit us, or for some voice to whisper in our ears what it is. Because that will, at the end of the day, be ourselves talking to ourselves. How do we process these things? Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It is all a process of how do you think about issues. And you know, in life, sometimes you never really find the final answer, but you find the answer you can live with. A student one time made a comment that was beyond his age. He said, he was looking for a church to be a pastor of a church, and he said, I'm not looking for a church that is perfect. I'm looking for a church that has the kinds of problems that I think that I can help. That was pretty wise. And if you find a perfect church, don't join it because you'll ruin it, you know? You don't want to do that. All right, now, an understanding of how a worldview works. Let's think a little bit about worldview. Do you think in worldview categories? Is this nomenclature that's you're used to using, or is it something new? Worldview, how we view our world. I I never really know when I go into various settings. But worldview and value set. You see, once again, we're back to my little stick figure. Because the Bible says that everything is adjudicated through the thinking process. As a person thinks, out of the heart, out of the rational process, come the issues of life. Be transformed by the renewing of your thought, not the renewing of your emotions, the renewing of the way you think. Change the way you think. And so worldview and values is all centered right there. We will do what we value. I find it amazing as I watched the traffic for the ball game. Now, I have to admit, I've liked sports a little bit, but I've never been a big sports fan. But I've never figured out why it is that people will spend thousands of dollars to go to a ball game of a school which they never attended. You know, have you ever wondered about that? They didn't go to school there. Why are they so rabid about that school's athletic program? I've never quite figured that out. But they have a value. It may be Notre Dame. It may be Syracuse. It may be Michigan. Or the ones with the biggest values are those who are Cubs fans. You know, the Chicago Cubs. Did they make it this year? How far did they get? Almost. That's like heaven to a Cubs fan because they're not used to those kinds of things. And so values, you'll buy and spend money on things that you value. You'll sacrifice for things that you value. Well, when it comes to our Christian lives, just how much of it do we value? How much do we expend ourselves personally? Our energies, our thought, to be able to promote the community of believers with which we're associated. If we do, and to the extent that we do, it's an issue of our values. Because we will chase what we value. So what are values? Well, worldview and values. A value is a mental framework by which we explain our world. So if we value life, when a decision about life is run through our mind, we will make a decision that values that. If life is nothing but biology to us and there's nothing beyond the current life, we will look at those things differently. There's interesting studies in capital punishment. As there was a declining view of the fact of an eternal life in American culture, there was also a declining of capital punishment because this life is all that we have. So therefore, we must be sure that we do absolutely nothing to cut this life short. It's an interesting thing. Our worldview has even affected our political and criminal justice systems. And I'm sure in your own disciplines, you could see things like this as well, that as culture changes the way it thinks about things, it has effects on other areas. And so consequently, a worldview is a mental framework. Values are the personal beliefs derived from our worldview that guide our thinking and actions. For a Christian, what is the ultimate value? What is the ultimate basic belief for us as Christians? What's the most ultimate thing you can think as a belief system for us? Yeah. And one step back beyond that is God exists. I am that I am. That there is a God. That's a pretty huge commitment, you know. That God is really there. In spite of the things in our world. As I get older, I think realistic about some of these things, and I thought about a book title. Here it is. Belief Against Reason. Coming to the crossroads of believing or bitterness. Have you ever felt that God has abandoned you? Has the abandonment been so severe that you wonder, maybe I've sold myself to a myth after all? You see, a basic belief that there really is a God in spite of the hardships of life is at the very core of our value system. What did Job say? Though he slay me, yet will I serve him. Fascinating statement in the book of Job. And we have, some say, I read this from time to time, that today there may be as many Christian martyrs on our globe as there have ever been. That daily people are dying for their faith. Now, when you're going to die for your faith, that's a very basic belief, isn't it? We don't face that in our culture here in the States. We may face other pieces, but not that. A basic personal belief. What would you die for? When you ask yourself that question, you're getting to the very core of your commitments. Another question, what makes you happy? What is it that makes you happy? When you ask that question, you're getting to the very core of who you are. And you have to evaluate that, is what makes you happy really important? Really meaningful. Lots of things make me happy. And one of them is I play a banjo. I really enjoy that. I don't have to think about it, I just go do it. Play a banjo. Makes me really happy. But that's not the same kind of happiness as doing what God has called me as an individual to do. Those are two very different kinds of happiness. But what makes us happy? We've got to ask ourselves those kinds of questions seriously to be able to get to the core of what drives us as human beings, because your decisions are going to be driven at the end of the day by your values. What is it that you really value in life? Think about it this way. I know here again, you may have to look at your sheet, and it's a little hard to see, I know. I'd need a magnifying glass myself. But what I have here is in the middle of that, we have worldview. That's the middle dot there, the red one. That's worldview. These satellites are all the issues that you face in life. You just faced the presidential election. Well, your values were a part of your determining who you voted for. You send your children to school. Do you send them to a full public school, a good private school? Do you homeschool? When you make those decisions, you're making them on the basis of certain values. And sometimes you can change your decisions because your values change or your location changes. When you send your children to college, where do you send them? How do you guide them? How do you help them to make good decisions in life? Well, you can try as much as you want, but they still won't listen. I never listened. I don't know if anybody ever listens very well. Certainly not in my cultural setting did we ever listen very well. And I look back to the advice I was given. Yeah, I should have taken that. You know, that was better than listening to myself. And particularly in American Caucasian cultural tradition, there's very little respect for age, and very little respect sometimes from children to their parents, particularly when they're teenagers. What's the biggest value of America, by the way? America as America, what's its biggest value? What do you think America's biggest value would be? Freedom. That's exactly right. Freedom. That is the core value, I think, of American culture. Now, I value freedom. I wouldn't like it taken away. But I have to say that that's not exactly a core biblical value. Community responsibility is a core biblical value. Responsibility to God. What's the great commandment? Love God and love your neighbor. Responsibility to God, responsibility to one another. Those are the core values of the Bible. Our culture is beginning to show its rare, its ragged edges of greed, self-centeredness, and so forth in our in the economic situation that we find ourselves in. Our values aren't really that good sometimes, and we're beginning to reap the awful payment that comes from that. So when we ask these questions, and questions that we might ask, what is God's will for the world for about armed conflict and war? That one has just changed, you know, because the Christian church held no preemptive action as God's will for war until terrorism struck. And they had, in fact, I have books that come across my desk written about just war theory. In other words, scholars are redefining the whole issue and wrestling with the issue of what is a just war theory for the church. Interesting days. What is God's will for modern medicine? How far? Medicine can go so far. It's so amazing to keep us alive. But sometimes, is that the right choice? Where should I educate my children? What church should I attend? How does the church choose a pastor? What theology should I follow? What does it mean to be spiritual? All of these are questions that we ask, and we look to the scriptures for answers. And so in that next slide, the organizing worldview and value set, all of the questions that we're asking have to be run through the worldview and values that are a part of us. And the answers will come out on the other side. And some of those are very important, and some of those the church would be unified on across all denominational lines. But some of them, we might find a variety of answers. And so we gravitate to the communities that have chosen the answers that we believe are right. And that's diversity. And for whatever reason, God hasn't chosen to make the church monolithic in our current settings. The church is diverse. And God hasn't stepped in to intervene and override that. And that's the wisdom of God that we don't have much access to. I use the analogy of the Tower of Babel. Maybe that's God's rationale. I don't know, so that we human beings don't get too high-minded. But whatever the case, it's there. A perfect Bible, imperfect interpreters is our challenge. Well, that's probably about as long as you can handle for a moment. So why don't we take a break? I know we've got some refreshments, and maybe take 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll come back and pick it up.